Welcome to the Near Post Local, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. Football in the capital region. I'm Peter Funnell. Tonight's program is the first in a four-part series of interviews with Australian football sage and national treasure, Ron Smith. Ron has done a lot in football and on a world stage, player, elite-level coach, and football analyst of world-class standard. Some call him the Brains Trust. Not a bad title for this bloke. Ron has been engaged by Capital Football to review our high-performance program. It couldn't be in better hands. Part one of this series starts in an unusual way, and I'd like to share it with the Near Post listener. When you interview someone like Ron about football, best to let him follow his path. And so it is with these interviews. We cover a lot of ground, and it tells you a lot about Ron Smith. Just fantastic. We began by roughing out what we were going to cover, and straight away we found ourselves into the subject, as easy as pie. I had opened the door on Ron's football knowledge, and it was simply overwhelming. I suddenly realised I hadn't introduced Ron, and did so. No harm done, free kick taken, then we got straight on with the rest of it. So I left that little snippet in as part of the part one of the series. As I drove home, I thought to myself, the FFA should sponsor the National Archives to sit Ron down and just let him talk about football. It would take a fair while because the bloke knows so much, but what an incredible oral history it would be. So relevant to today, and there would just have to be a book in it somewhere, and he isn't finished yet. Just amazing. Listen carefully is my best advice, and follow the other interviews on the Near Post Local blog site. When Ron comes calling to speak on the HPP, or you reckon you've got something that needs saying, well, do it. You'll have made a contribution to our young players, present and future. So here we go. Ron's talking about what the Liverpool coach asked him to do a while ago, and it's game on.
See, I didn't assist Gerard Houllier with video analysis. He invited me there.
There you go.
Because he wanted to find out what I was doing, because someone told him. Yeah. I'd been researching goal scoring patterns. And I'd made some distinct differences between our Liverpool, Man United and Arsenal score goals.
He broke the game down.
And he was interested to say, you know,
found the patterns.
I went and gave a presentation to the coaching staff at Liverpool.
Fascinating.
And was a guest there. He said, stay as long as you want. 3 months if you want to come. I said, no, a month. Month will be plenty because I've got a job, you know, but he was great.
Fantastic.
But he, you know, so.
Then if we can talk about the terms of reference, just in the broad.
Yeah, sure.
I'll ask you how you intend to sort of approach this task, what your method might be at this point. The time frames, when are you likely to produce the first draft, so people have an idea of the time frame this is in. And who are you looking for to make direct contribution? Will you consult other states on their high-performance solutions, that sort of thing? The only reason I ask that is because some of the programs we've done have been with the technical directors or the people running some of the other programs.
Yeah, I'm familiar with a lot anyway. Yeah. I've spent my life in the game here.
Yeah, of course. With this is just saying, hey, look, you know, we're doing this, other people are doing this. Maybe there's merit in having a look at what they're doing. You know, keep the good bits at work and throw away the bits and replace them that don't.
Well, that's the whole point of reviewing things, is to say, you know, what's happening and, you know, where are you going to go from here?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hoping that out of this, and I'm sort of like, I've got a good idea what goes on in Canberra, like I've got a good idea what goes on, but until you actually go and talk to people and
say,
what are some of the issues that you face as a high-performance coach?
Yeah.
And then they'll say, well, there's this, that and the other. Now, you could tease it out of me because I've been a high-performance coach at the international level.
Yeah.
So my problems will be very different to some of the issues that people will face a little bit lower down the food chain.
Well, that's right.
Like, we've got crap grounds, poor lighting.
Yeah.
I ran a senior course here about 3 years ago, and I went to see some people in their own environment to assess their coaching skills.
Yeah.
And in one particular case, I walked to the guy and I said, listen, I'll come and actually assess you when you've got a chance to coach. Because I said, under these conditions, all you can do is just train the players, give them something to run about with. You can't teach anyone anything here, hardly. The visibility is pathetic. The area that you've got to work in is so limited, you can't do anything of any sort of quality at the level that this course is aimed at. So you're basically a trainer. Now, you're doing a great job in that, but until you can get at least half a field to train on and practice and people can see what they're doing, as a coach, you're wasting your time. You've got no chance. So what I'm saying is, and this is one of the things, that's why I was interested to do it. I think sometimes you need some opinion from a practitioner and not just someone who's going to observe and assess it without looking at the quality factors.
Yes.
And that's where I come in.
Yep.
But everything I've done in my life is all about trying to improve the quality and raise the bar, raise the standard. So I was pedantic. When I was at the OS, nobody set foot on those two pitches unless I said so. And the last one they ever had to worry about ruining those grounds was that was my office. So if I thought training on there tonight is going to damage it, training's off, boys. That's why we had the synthetic put in. And the indoor hall.
Well, they're the tools of your trade.
We designed, exactly. It's like saying to someone who's got a $25,000 computer, well, don't turn it on and off 10 times in 15 seconds, you might stuff it up. They're not going to do that.
No.
They'll polish it and make sure it's... And that's how you are with your grounds.
Yes.
I don't need the groundsman to say to me, you can't train on there tonight. If he said you could train on there tonight, I'd smack him. I'd say, you what?
More power to you, mate.
You know, but... So I'm trying to look a little bit deeper than the surface stuff.
We're speaking to Ron Smith. He's a highly experienced and well-regarded football coach and analyst. That's a football analyst. He has a world experience in the world game. Now, the purpose of this interview is important to us in the ACT football community because Ron's been commissioned by Capital Football to conduct a thorough review of the high-performance program in all its facets.
Yeah.
Ron, how are you?
I'm good, Peter. Thank you.
Wow, what a nice job you've got.
Oh, it's, I mean, it's. I was very interested when I was approached to do this. You know, I've lived in the ACT now for 28, 29 years. And although I've actually never really worked within the ACT, I've, you know, most of that time, obviously, was at the AIS. I spent 14 years there. But I've been living here and overseas, but I've always had my base here since... I came to work at the OS in the second year, but I've actually never worked for an ACT organisation, so to speak. I've done other things like coaching courses and conducted things like that in the ACT, but the idea of reviewing the high performance programme has really given me an opportunity to have a very close look and a chance to speak to people that are immersed in it.
Yeah, I couldn't think of anyone better credentialed than you, but I think you're being too humble. Just tell us a little bit more about your football journey. This is important to the listener. You tend to understate what you've done.
Well, I suppose in the big picture, you see, football's a world game.
Yeah.
And if you look, you know, at the big picture in football, you might say, well, I've made a contribution in this country to the sport.
Yep.
But on the world scene, you know, I'd be way down the list, so to speak. Doesn't mean to say I'm not proud of what I've achieved as a coach. I've been 35 years, I've worked in the game on a full-time basis.
Yeah.
I've done almost...
You're one of the very few.
I'd be the only one that's worked that long. And the only reason I've been able to do that is because I've diversified skills and tried to develop abilities in order to keep being employed and to do a better job. And I'm still doing it now to this day.
Well, well, you make a good point there because you've got a pretty comprehensive football CV. In terms of this review, you'd be one of the front runners, I would have thought, internationally in terms of football analysis. Can you tell us a little bit about this? Because you've got to have good analytical skills to do a review, and you certainly have them.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you pick on that, Peter, because coaches... are always analysing.
Yeah.
It's just which tools do you use? And a former national director of coaching in Australia, Eric Worthington, who's unfortunately not with us anymore, said to me once, back in the 70s, you see what you know when it comes to football. People look, but they don't all see.
Yeah.
And it's true. And so as a coach, you're continually evaluating against your knowledge base.
Mm.
And some people will look at something and go, well, that looks pretty good. Mm. And somebody else will look at it and go, that's awful.
Mm.
It depends what you're comparing it with and what you know about the game and maybe about performance levels.
Mm.
But to come back to the question about analysis, I always base my coaching at the AIS with potential international players on analysis. And I used to say, look, if I show you the behaviours that the top 10 strikers in the world all have in common, do you think that would be a good starting point for you? Because they're all playing in World Cups, the best leagues all over the world, and most of them are multi-millionaires for doing it.
Mm.
And I have yet to find a young player who says, no, I don't fancy that. And so
they're hungry to know what the others are doing.
Yeah, they're hanging on, well, just show me the behaviours,
yeah.
To use that term, and they get used to that expression. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that all through my coaching career, I've not done things because I sort of say, well, you know, I'm Ron Smith and so do it because I say so. No, I've never done that.
Mm.
But I've actually shown players, look, these are the things that will lead to success. And if you can identify what it is that you need to learn, most people then have a chance.
Facts based on observation.
All on analysis. And then, so that's been like part of my, and obviously I'm a football nut, so to speak. Somebody said to me last night, you know, about the games, because I've been sort of analysing football for a whole variety of reasons for years, and you know, I've probably got every game that Arsenal, Liverpool, Man United have played for the last 10 years.
Fair dinkum.
Wow. Oh, and in Champions League, every Champions League game that's been played for the last probably 9 years, every World Cup, European Championship. Thank God they went to DVD because my house was getting full of tapes.
Well, I've got to admit, Arsene Wenger is one of my favourites.
Well, I think he's wonderful. I really do. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that I like to actually look at football in the current era and then say certain things are happening now in the game. And the game is always evolving.
Yeah.
And a bit like fashion, you know, bell bottoms come in sometimes and people go, God, we used to wear bell-bottom trousers in the 60s. Well, football's a bit like that with so-called systems of play, which I think are grossly overrated.
Yeah.
They have so little impact in football if you actually look at it closely.
Mm-hmm.
That it's more for the spectators and the programmes than it is about actually playing a game.
Mm.
So anyway, I could talk about that for a couple of hours. But so then what's happened later in my career is that as I've got more and more interested in the evolution of football and what's happening, but more importantly, what leads to successful play in attacking and defending mode, and also the introduction of computer software.
Yes.
You know, 15 years ago, it was in its infancy. 10 years ago, or 11 years ago, I got my hands on the first sports code system.
Oh, yes.
And it just blew my mind away, what you could do with it.
Because now you have the ability to analyse at speed.
Well, yeah.
And in detail.
And that was 10 years ago. Now, like in all things, what that company now provides 10 years down the track compared to 10 years ago is like night and day.
Yes, I imagine.
It is so sophisticated and user-friendly now. And it's limited by your imagination as the user.
Mm.
It's just fantastic. So that then allows you to be far more creative in the way you actually analyse football. And it just keeps going.
Yeah.
And so, and now, obviously, because of having a background of coaching at the highest level, in the last, you know, sort of like a couple of World Cups and so on, before the 2004-05, I came back from overseas and I started to work for Frank Farina. He was one of my former players at the AIS, was the national coach, and he was very keen for me to actually work and help him with the analysis of the team and for feedback purposes and say, well, how well are we doing this, or what should we be trying to do a little bit more of? What do you think? Show us. not opinion, evidence. And then how does this compare with other teams? So in that kind of capacity, what I've done is I've spent the last 6 or 7 years working with the Socceroos to analyse opponents, provide information about consistency, patterns of play, more about opponents actually than our own team, because I don't think in that 5 or 6 years I've ever been in a situation where the same team's played 2 consecutive games.
Oh, that's a good point, isn't it?
Except at the World Cup.
Yes.
From one World Cup to the next, you know, there's barely been a time when there hasn't been at least, say, 3 or 4 changes to the national side in every game we've played.
Yeah.
And also the introduction of other technologies to be able to provide feedback for people on the other side of the world when they can access it and all these things. So that's all been part of the evolution of a coach. Because basically that's what I am.
Well,
I'm a coach.
Thank you for saying that, because the point I think the listener's got to pick up on here is if we're going to do a review, and we are going to do a review of this high-performance program, we need to have someone like yourself that not only has participated in various roles at the highest level, but also has a complete understanding of the technologies and support systems that surround the elite player. And that must inform how we structure our high-performance program, or at least it must influence it. To some degree, with
them. Enormously.
Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that applies equally with the Socceroos.
Yeah.
If you go, like, in the last 6 to 7 years, the amount of money that's been invested in trying to actually improve the high performance program has been massive.
Yes.
And so the bottom line is, how much have you got to become more serious?
Mm-hmm.
And that applies all the way down. So you can talk about the Socceroos, like when Gus Hiddink said, well, if we're not going to have a chartered flight back from Montevideo, are we serious? Are you serious about going to the World Cup? If you're not serious about going to the World Cup,
we'll
just go on a domestic flight.
That's right.
And I'll probably go to the World Cup with another team. But if you're serious, well then, you know, we need that chartered flight more than anything else, at a cost.
All right, that's great. That's true.
See, that was Gus Hiddink's view. Yep. Of high performance.
Yeah.
Well, if you're not serious about high performance,
yeah.
The World Cup, if that ain't the highest thing and you're not going to do what is basic,
yeah.
Well, then you can't be serious.
No.
You could say exactly the same about the under 13 girls program in the ACT.
Yes.
If this is where they're going to train, you can't be serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's like it's a principle and you can only do what you can do with the given.
Resources
and time and everything else. So,
but you do have to optimise them, don't you?
Yeah, and you keep striving to get better next year or better next week,
etc.
Same as at the World Cup.
Yep.
You know, the 2004 experience, 2002 experience for the qualification and all that. Frank did everything he could with what he had at his resources.
Yes.
You know, what we did for 2006... What I did with 6 coaches to scout 7 teams in South America, one of whom we would play in November. We started doing that long before Gus Hiddink was even in the frame.
Gee.
You know, I could tell you a story about what we did to prepare for that 2-game series.
Well, mate, this is another
from
interview.
7 months before. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just even the week of playing the 2 matches against Uruguay was a phenomenal. It was like a military exercise. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, that's high performance at a cost.
Yes.
They never had the resources to do that for 2002.
Yes.
Most of the things we did for 2006, they couldn't do in 2002.
Mm.
End result, they didn't qualify in 2002.
Mm.
Didn't mean to say they weren't serious, but you can only do so much with the given resources and the funding that you've got.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Doesn't mean that people aren't serious. I know we use that as a kind of a bit of an expression, and you might think it's in a joking fashion, and it is in a bit tongue-in-cheek. But the fact is, you are limited by the resources available as to how serious you can actually be.
Yep. That's it in a nutshell. You've summed the whole thing up. Now, and that's important, I think, for parents to know when they put their kids into these programs, that they know that this is serious. It comes at a cost to the families in most of the programs around Australia. And I hesitate to use the word value for money, but they've got to know that this is going somewhere for the benefit of the kids. And yeah. I guess the point I'm trying to make here in a rather ham-fisted way is you be as professional as it's possible to be at the level with the resources available. And people understand that, I think.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it's also the people that are working there. Mm. It's so easy to criticise anything that people do.
Yeah, absolutely right there.
And to be able to say, oh, this coach, he's not really good enough to do this or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but the guy, you say, well, what incentive? And these are the sort of things that I want to try and tease out of the review.
Yeah.
Apart from the obvious about looking at, well, what's the client satisfaction like? What does it actually cost the client?
Yeah.
What would you like? What's missing out of the program?
Mm.
By the coach, by the parent, by the athlete? What would you like more of or less of? Do you think you get enough of this?
Mm.
And what's the quality like all the time?
Yep.
And that brings you then into looking at, well, where do you train?
Yeah.
What's the quality of the surface like for most of the people?
Uh-huh.
You could have the best coaches in the world, but if they're actually training people in semi-darkness on a lumpy pitch, you're wasting your time and effort.
Yeah.
You will not get the end result that you hope for.
Yeah. There isn't a player, a coach, or a club official that isn't applauding at the present moment, because that's the way we live in football at the present moment.
It is, and you know, and I at the World Cup recently there were little mini programs on that they did on all sorts of situations that people are faced around the world who are now competing at the World Cup.
Yeah,
and they gave little TV programs about the plight of some of the African nations.
Mm.
And you see kids still playing with footballs made of bags of rags and tied together with string.
Yeah.
And you think, is that really happening? Yes, and it is. All over Africa, and kids are playing in bare feet.
Mm.
And now you would say, well, should we do the same then? If they can do it, well, then we don't have to worry. Let's just play on dung heaps, cow paddocks. They don't even have a ball that's blown up. Don't even have boots on. We're going backwards, not forwards. So that's why that doesn't happen.
Yeah, correct.
But, you know, what I'm saying is, you can always say someone's worse off than you. Yes.
But it doesn't help you go forward.
No, and there's always someone who's better off than you.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
You know, and so what you're trying to do with any kind of program and all the people that work in it is you're trying to get the best bang for your buck, to use an old cliche.
Yeah.
And you're trying to get the people that have got the best to offer at any given time to keep doing it.
Yes.
Often, with very little compensation.
Yeah.
And so the other thing that out of this review I'm hoping, from talking to coaches working in our Premier League, coaches working in the high performance programs, in the men's and women's, you know, why do you do it?
Yeah.
What are you doing it for? Are you being compensated for? And if so, is that adequate?
It's a terrific question to ask these people, because I don't think, unless you're there at every training session at a club and you see the development of the players over the season and the games they play every week, without offending the near past listener, you actually don't know what the journey is like. And it is torturous at clubs at times. And it all comes to a point with that coach. The dollar stops with the coach just about every time.
Yeah. And everybody does twice as much.
Yeah.
Than they're paid for.
Absolutely.
That's life in football. Yeah. And it happens for the people that are paid good salaries.
Yeah.
They actually devalue their salaries because instead of working 60 hours a week, they work 100.
Yeah, consume their life.
And you lose a life. Yeah. I know, because I've done it. I've been totally burnt out in my life to the point where I've looked for reasons not to actually go on the football pitch for a training session. And that's been my lifeblood and motivation for over 30 years. So I've experienced that. I've also been to the point where I've been perched in front of a computer until 3 o'clock in the morning because I've got to get something finished.
Yes.
There's no, football doesn't have, oh, we'll file that, we'll do it tomorrow.
Mm.
And that's sport across the board. You have, if you're in it, you're in it 24/7 and you have to be totally committed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that's ideal. But, you know, you'll find coaches like me who put no less hours than Jose Mourinho. In fact, I may do more than Jose Mourinho, but when he gets sacked, he gets a $48 million payout. When people like me get sacked, you're lucky if you get your contract
paid. You get a ticket for the Manly Ferry,
yeah. Yeah, but, you know, so these rules are applied right across, because you're a coach.
Yeah, that's it. Absolutely got it.
But when I say, yeah, there's coaching and coaching, you know, and pressure to survive financially in the world is upon everybody,
yes.
Not just people that are, you know, working in the supermarket or the postman or the accountant or whatever.
Yep.
It's just the same. If you're a football coach, you've got a mortgage and whatnot, there's more pressure on than winning that game on Saturday than any putt that's worth $2 million for Tiger Woods.
Well, absolutely.
But that's what I'm saying is, but the principles apply to everybody.
Yes, that's
right. And it's like high performance. Everyone's trying to do their bit. It's where are you in the food chain and so on and so on. What have you got at your disposal?
Well, I want to ask you something else about this high performance routine. In the most recent times, we've had the arrival of this new national football curriculum. Now, we never had one of those before. And
that's correct.
And that puts a peg in the ground for everyone to operate from. And, of course, from that has come these high-performance programs. Each state has implemented what seems to me to be its version of that in terms of the game development intentions. With the interviews we've had with some of these technical directors, each state and territory has gone down its own path. I guess, if for no other reason than it's trying to particularise the situation for some of the reasons you've talked about, how much resources, what are the environmental factors in the area you're in? You know, you're massively dispersed like Western Australia, or you're clumped up here in the ACT with a lesser number than New South Wales, and so on, all the stuff you hear.
Yeah.
We don't seem to have one model. We have a variety of them. No one's better placed than you to see this.
Yeah.
See this across the Australian football spectrum, particularly where this high performance program operates in the junior and lower end of youth.
Yeah.
How much influence are those other models likely to exert on you?
Well, first off, can I just make a couple of comments on a couple of things that you've said there? That first of all, about the national curriculum, it's something that people like me have been fighting for 35 years.
Yeah.
But you need to understand the hierarchy of control. Until Frank Lowy basically became the chairman of Football Australia, and it was kind of reformed as a body with a whole new constitution, which they took nearly 4 years to get the states to agree to. Nobody had any power to say, this will now be the policy.
Yep.
And so out of that, because FFA now have got all the states to agree to a new constitution, they now are in the position where they can say, this is going to be the way forward. Yep. This is our national curriculum.
Yep.
And we're going to introduce all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you will do it.
Yeah.
Because you've agreed to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? Those that didn't want to agree to do it were free to leave. But for the sake of the sport and making more progress, we couldn't have people going off at a tangent doing this and the other.
Clearly.
But having said that, you won't find programs the same in every state because they've all got different conditions to deal with.
Correct.
You look at the demographics of Queensland, where I worked for 2 years in 1980 and 81. Mm. In those days, and still, in fact, we had more full-time coaches in 1980 than they've got now.
Is that right?
Yeah, I had a regional coach in every major city in Queensland, with the exception of Cairns, but that came later.
Mm.
But all the way, I had about 7 full-time staff. New South Wales had one person with, you know, 20 times the number of players. Mm. It was ludicrous.
Mm. Mm.
But things haven't changed that much in New South Wales, still.
Mm.
But anyway, that's another story. But what I'm saying is the reason Queensland had that was because of the dispersion of their communities, where they had big enough communities in isolated places. Our issues in the ACT are totally different, and the problems that we face compared to New South Wales or Victoria, West Australia, etc., etc. So the programs are basically, you have a principle, how do you put your high performance programs in, and then what suits what you've got and your particular problems. But in principle, There have always been high performance programs.
In some form or another. Academies were used
forever. Yeah. I mean, like the first, after we'd had the AOS going from, it opened in 81, it was around 1991, around that period, when basketball was the first sport to actually start linking their state based programs, and through federal and state funding, we actually got the VIS. And the WACE program in the West. The WACE was the first to have a football program. Mm. Ron Tinder was the first head coach there in about 91, 92. Mm. The next one we got off the ground was in Victoria. And I was heavily involved in the composition of squads, that it wasn't going to be all one age. It was a composite group to try and identify talent over a 3 or 4 year age bracket. The coaches and so on and so on. Because all the things that we'd learned from 10 years at the OAS, we wanted to get out into the communities with other slightly younger elite players so that we could start the education process and developing good habits, lifestyle habits, performance, technique and all this, and improve the standard of coaching.
Habits is a very good
we
word,
we had to
it?
Get that out. So, and so it evolved. These were all high-performance programs. And so the younger ones were targeted towards our national junior under-17s, the Joeys. And then the AIS, which had been seen as the first one, and, you know, it was really thanks to the vision of Sir Arthur George, who was the former president of the ASF, that got soccer in the one of the first eight programs in 81 at the AIS. I've got time for a funny story, but...
Yeah, absolutely.
When, and I came... Jimmy Shoulder was appointed as the first head coach, and the first meeting he went to with the other... seven head coaches. Don Talbot and Peter Bowman were the two guys who ran. Don was the director, but Peter said to the coaches, right, I'll tell you how many scholarships you've got. And it was going to be like, you know, 21 for track and field and so many for this sport, so many for that sport, and soccer's got eight.
Well, we haven't got a team.
But he didn't know that at the time. And Jimmy said, well, we're going to have a slight problem there, Pete. He said, why, what do you mean? He said, well, first off, we need 11 to have a game. He said, and you're going to get a few injuries and sickness, so you can't survive for a whole, you know, season on 11 players.
We have goalkeepers as well. Yeah.
So they actually stole some from track and field and basketball and whatnot and finished up with 16. But that was the start of the OAS. And thanks to people like Peter Bowman, who spent most of his life working there, and Don Talbot, you know, they were real pioneer days.
Yeah.
High performance program.
Yeah.
And what happened in the latter days when I was the head coach compared to what happened in 1981, it's like chalk and cheese, because people learn from what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so on and so on. So, you know, even at state level all the time, that we've had high performance, but we've never had a curriculum like we've got now. But everyone's tried to get it. I'll give you an example. In 1978, I stood up at a club delegates meeting in Melbourne, and we'd been pushing for nearly 3 years to get small-sided games adopted. Sure. All the other sports said we were crazy. We'll steal all your players because they won't play. They want little trophies and pots and things like that. That's all they play sport for. And we said, well, we're going to do it regardless. So we did.
What a powerful influence small-sided games has been.
But it changed. Before long, there was Waller Rugby, net-to-net ball. Yep. Everyone hung
all
their hats
on
it. Exactly. So we led the way in that respect. Kanga cricket, everything. They brought basketball nets down, used smaller basketballs, which was all common sense. So, you know, we led the way in it. What we didn't do was actually put a name on it. But I stood up at a meeting in 78 and said, if you don't adopt this as policy, I'm going to resign next week. I said, because I'm wasting my time here. And I did. The club delegates didn't. So I said, OK, I'm out of here. Thanks very much. I've had 3 years. I wasn't going to bash my head against a brick wall for much longer.
And, you know, I spoke to, some time ago now, to John Mitchell, who's well known to the...
I know John. He's a good friend of mine.
And he has some terrific ideas in football. He made a real difference. And
absolutely.
We were talking about this very problem. About scaling it down, if I can use that term, to suit the... But we also said that when they got older, we referred to a group of crusty old fellas who get down at Mawson playing fields on a Sunday morning, and guess what they do? They play small-sided games because they're a bit too old to go kicking at 100 metres. And there you go. It works for them. They have a great time.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do it if it works?
Exactly. Yeah. Again, I could talk to you for an hour about the benefits of small sided games.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I say, it's progress. We've now got to the point where, regardless of who's doing it, we've got a national curriculum, we've got a national development plan.
Mm.
And all of that means that you want to do more.
You have been listening to the Near Post Local, and we have been speaking to football sage Ron Smith about his current mission to review the Capital Football High Performance Program. Well, that's it for the Near Post Local. If you want this podcast, go to www.nearpostlocal.blogspot.com. You'll find a lot of other interesting materials around football there for your consumption. Enjoy your football and futsal. See you next time. Ta-da. Round and round, up and down, through the streets of your